know whether to talk about that one thing or not that we were talking about, whether or not we would talk about or not talk about, or that we do or don't talk about.
But we could talk about it.
Yeah. The role of objectivity or the lack thereof in one's practice, and whether it's important or not important that ultimate reality is really real or not really real, or that the world is really real or not really real. And is that right? Ostensibly, to my practice at least, it's important that things are not really real, that things are, that things exist in the realm of conception, and that allows malleability, but also it allows a hope because of the malleability that suggests that things don't have to be stuck in the way that they are interminably or indefinitely, which is not to say that they're not also stuck for extended periods of time that feel interminable.
I want to perhaps scratch beneath where concepts and abstractions, where it's almost like you get too close to, there's an idea of actus purus, like a pure act, God as pure act, and I'm a sort of spark in the blaze that is God. You know, I'm like, I want to kind of scratch beneath there and say, like, it's just so important to me for the life of devotion to understand in what ways my being is held by love. There's an objective, there's a vision too close.
That's the word that derailed you.
There's a vision too intimate to reach out to an object, you know, like beyond itself.
There's a vision too intimate to reach out to an object beyond itself.
Where our actuality is like a spark inside the blaze that is being itself. There's an intimacy with reality. There's an existential intimacy that is too close for objects to intrude. And that devotion, after we go past that, then everything's up for grabs. But the intuitive,
but between you and your relationship with that reality,
yeah, it's like
there should be nothing between those.
Well, that there's a contact too close for images. It's too close for concepts. It's too close for elaborations. It's so close that we can't. Now we can elaborate about the inability to elaborate about it, and we can engage in that. For me, or just awakening to the reality itself loves you. You're held in being by. Those are concepts, but there's a closeness in. When I think of all the ways in which we can relate to reality in Hinduism as a servant, as a brother, as a child, as a father, as a mother, Hanuman as servant, you know, Krishna.
Well, and as a spark within the greater being,
a blaze.
That is God, that is you. Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it sounded
very Hindu from you for a moment, conspicuously Hindu from you.
And conspicuously Christian in the sense that they want to go, like the Hindus, to bride and bridegroom, to Krishna and Radha, to the intimacy that occurs between lovers is often an intimacy that seems upon which image and concept we can talk about it, but it can't intrude. There's a way in which that the figure of the bride and the bridegroom, or of lovers, is a very good description for this spark within a blaze for me.
As we see within the Song of Songs.
As we see in the Song of Songs, and we see with Krishna and Radha. And by the way, correction from past podcast, I meant to say Sita and Ram, not Krishna and Sita in speaking of.
Okay.
And then also correction. And it can go in. Sri Guru Charana Saroja Raja Nija Mana Mukuru Sudari. May I polish the mirror of my heart with the dust of my guru's feet. So I translated that thing wrong. So sorry for the segue. Maybe the corrections there at that point, but I just wanted to say that for the record. But this, there's something in, how can we know that which is invisible or that which is, how is it that these parables and figures, it's a language, it's a familiar language that's used to point us towards this direct vision that is what I'm describing to say is too close for images and concepts. So, because I believe...
What do images and concepts have to do with distance? I mean, it's an interesting thing to me because as I think you know, Buddhism supposes that construct conceptuality, right, or the capacity of the mind to project or to interact through archetypes, it is not an impediment to intimacy, and in fact facilitates intimacy. But
there is a tradition going.
No.
Until it is an obstacle. It's a portal until it is no longer a portal. It's a figure until it's no longer a figure. It's allegory until it's no longer allegory. It's system until it's no longer system. It's system based on images and stories and concepts until it's no longer a system based on image. There's a risen, there's a...
And I don't know, right, of course, I don't know that I personally accept that or subscribe to that, but it's a debate, look, even within Buddhism, of course, about whether we are meant to transcend conception or embrace conception, and whether the idea of the transcendence of conception is conception itself, whether the,
well said. The
idea that we could somehow see all things as limited to conception and see the lack that there could be anything other than that, whether we view that through the lens of conception. This is hotly contested. And to say it's hotly contested between different branches of Buddhism, you know, it's even contested in I think a lot of people's understanding of the whatever sub branch that seems to suppose things are all conceptual in the lineage of Jetsongkhapa, where Jetsongkhapa does talk about non-conceptuality, but doesn't seem, as far as I can understand, all right, but doesn't seem to mean non-conceptual in the way that we would normally think of non-conceptual. Yeah. I don't think that he means that there's no conception per se, but that the conception, there's something about the sorts of conception that we've always had that are so wrong that we can call that state of union with ultimate reality non-conceptual, which is not to say that it couldn't be teased apart or pried apart, or that it is not dependent upon the mind to think of it as such. And that I just can't help it; just feels so clean to me, so neat, so tidy to me. That if that fact applies to everything, then even to look and see that there's nothing it doesn't apply to, that would still be an understanding that truth applies to. It just feels so tidy, elegant to say that emptiness is empty, to say that the lack of a thing which could come from anywhere other than conception is not a lack that could come from anywhere other than conception. it feels to me like the keystone that holds up the arch.
Yeah. And that seems to be post elaborations. Those words you shared, that those words are shareable. Who is sharing this? What is our reality? Who is doing the asking of this? Who is doing the projecting? Why is there a who to project? Who's the projector? Is there a projector? Am I projecting the projector? I don't know. But nonetheless, there's something happening. Oh, amen, bow down. And so there's some, I want to, and when you say at the beginning of that, what you're speaking of, when you say, well, a concept and non-conceptual, I think Christianity wants to move back and forth between them and understand the nature or the connection between the use of images and symbol and that which is beyond symbol, and use symbol as a bridge to something ineffable. And yes, it then is the stating of ineffability effabilized. Have you effabled ineffability into the world? Sure. And is that then a some sort of a label? Oh yes, but no, I'm not talking about that one. I'm talking about the label beyond olives. Oh, but you just labeled that. Yeah. So is there any way all of that right there? Is there a look we're not doing? Is there something we're not nodding to that's holding up the whole, what you just say, buttress, that's buttressing these buttresses? Is there a blaze of which I am a spark? Is there a way to engage in parable and allegory and concept that frees us to experience bliss and joy? Is there a...
And how does conception deny that? How does this, how does the insistence that such a thing...
It's not that it does, and that's not what I'm saying. It's not that it denies it. It's that it can deny it. It's that, not that, you see, that both are required. Conception moving you into, it doesn't deny it. It's simply saying that there's a direct experience of God into which concepts do not intrude, to which we could not have had that experience without concepts. Please. I mean, no Christian mystic would ever throw out the efficacy of liturgy, symbol, language, and they talk about it as such. But that there's an intimate union whereby concepts are no longer the currency.
Why do you suppose those would profane that space?
It's not profaned. It's not profane. It's a springboard.
Your point. You're saying it isn't, and I'm saying why? Yes. Why would you suppose that they were? Were they present in that space? I mean, you're presenting a space where it certainly is not profaned by those conceptions, and I'm not clear on why the presence of conception would profane that space.
I'm presenting a space where conception does not come up.
Right. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, I'm not presenting a space of denial or acceptance. I'm talking about a union and contact whereby we are so overcome. Out after the experience, one might say, oh my God, I'm held in being by love.
Yes.
Oh, I'm not pulling the shots at all. Oh, but I kind of am, because the spark, the collusion of wills is so close and tight. And then all these words spring from this experience of union, and it is a union, you know, and I want to say, damn it, it's a union.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
And I want to say, like, I don't know how without that, that's been so fundamental to unlocking a deeper relationship with reality, with truth for me. And
There's no system. Look, there's no system, right? There's no even Buddhist system that I'm aware of formally that denies a direct union where the directness of that experience with ultimate reality transcends our other sorts of experience with ultimate reality in a way such that one would even properly refer to it as non-conceptual. And and yet it seems to me, and it seems to me in my reading, at least of the, you know, in the tradition of the Dalai Lama's, you know, this philosophy, it seems to me, even at least in my reading of that, that it, that experience is still dependent upon mine to exist, in so much as we can't, in so much as existence itself is a human conception, attributing things with having a quality of existing or not is not something owned by things. It's humans, it's minds that fret about what things deserve the quality of existence or not existence, and not a thing which nature, you know, concerns itself with independently of us. And so to say that there is an experience had, a union between two things, as if they were separate things when no one is looking, or as if they could be the same thing when no one is looking. And infinite mind. Intimacy. Yeah, mind.
Mind is the blaze. My mind is spark within the blaze. Mm-hmm. And so we can use a different label for the blaze within which my life is but a divine spark. So mind, universal mind, particular minds, minds altogether creating, or mind streams, or then it gets there's something so crucial about understanding the world as given, as a gift, as something that has been bestowed, that something that happens by the emptying out of something, and that somehow our very created being, or being that we see as created, our sense of having been created without our own efforts, our sense of being a part of creation, there's a way in which seeing the self-emptying of a seed going into the ground, going into its darkness and becoming not itself to become what it was supposed to be, or the strange contradiction, apparent contradictions that happen to nature, dying to this self to become this, to become aware of this larger blaze that holds me in being, that there's some devotional act that is not privy to system and concept, but by which system and concept can help us to get behind a kind of a glorifying of truth, like a, there's something I have to scratch at below the level of concepts, and I don't, and I just trust that place, and I know that trusting that is somehow a part of using concepts in a more helpful way. Mm-hmm. So Ben, it's so above my, I feel almost like I'm grappling with things that are so, it's beyond, I feel well beyond my abilities right now, you know, and I have to just admit that I feel very unequal to the task of this discussion on some level. I feel more equal about the task of how whether or not you proclaim an objective blaze of which your subjective part is a spark, and then somehow that subjectivity is engulfed and you no longer see distinctions between subject and object, or maybe you do and see it as a projection and then you don't, or all the ways in which we could speak about that, that I'm just more comfortable going. And yet these philosophies that seem to have greater and lesser degrees of subjectivity or objectivity, or describe the poison of subjectivity, or describe the poison of objectivity, or whichever system we're in, mm-hmm. that underneath that, they seem to be expressed. And this, like, you're being run by a false self. They all seem to say there's something that you're thinking is true that isn't.
Yes.
And they seem to end in all these things, like we've said before, in humility, or in service, or in love, or in, and it seems to hang so together as if, my gosh, we really are in the same world. So there's got to be some way in which the Christian mystic's direct vision or union with God, to the extent to which is possible in this life, and different mystics have varying degrees of what they think is possible when you still have this body, and what happens when you take on an angelic body, or a risen body, or a resurrected body, or a body of light, or when you're Zokrimmed, which a completion body, a complete form of sorts, that they all seem to have the same modes for, similar methods seem to exist, or at least similar forms of behavior seem to be among them. That's where I don't feel qualified to talk about this almost. I feel like it's beyond my abilities, frankly.
I don't mean to like push, and I don't want to push you to a defensive place. And
fuck it, push.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. I think that we do an interesting job, you know, in these conversations of finding common ground and not pushing too much to where, you know, to the crux of where we think, you know, almost like seeking out the ground that's not common. To see whether or not it's common or not common.
Well said.
And we mostly don't do that. And I also think that it's, you know, also fine, and also surprisingly,
yes.
you know, it might be surprisingly safe to do that.
Yes.
And
yes.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know how to talk about this, the crux in a way that's, you know, I don't know, perfectly safe. Like, what is this difference, right? What is this difference between, yeah, God and emptiness, or a thing that we all belong to, or a thing that is a lack, and are they necessarily different? Is, or can we talk about the entire universe as a collection of karmic ripenings and unfoldings, and somehow that, I read somewhere, or heard somewhere, or, you know, maybe it was a TED talk, which people now mistake for having read something at some time or something, that that there's something about complexity that that's connected to the, like, an explanation for consciousness, that consciousness is a naturally emerging property of complexity, and that somehow that explains consciousness. And what we think is mysterious or magical is just such complexity that we don't know how to describe it, and that it somehow is as mechanistic as anything else. And and I like it. I don't know. I find it reassuring. I mean, you take a stab in the heart.
Well, an interesting one, only to say, oh, yes, my man, go ahead. And when you find those words that can explain something that in your previous state was unable to explain, you will find that in the words you use to explain that oh so profound new understanding, in the light of the mystery of your being, it's nothing. Oh, and by the way, when you do that new thing, and then you find words to describe the next level, by the way, that new level you've reached, and new ways of describing the impossible, it's also then you come to find out in the truth that is God, nothing, and so on and so forth. And I think that process is sacred.
But there's no scientist worth their salt who would then sit back and say, okay, and that's it, and I'm done describing. Because I just said that things are so complex that I can't describe them, now I'm done searching or something, or now things are settled. There's this, you know, discussion about complexity that there is more to be revealed, and that someone who, at least me, you know, at least one person who is allured by this idea of amazing complexity and the emergent properties of amazing complexity is only allured to keep seeking. It doesn't suddenly sit back and say, now I've tidily described reality by saying it's complex. Quite the contrary. It's complex. We could perhaps even say infinitely complex, that we could reveal more and more complexities. Is it impossible? I do chafe against the word impossible, because here we are.
Because here we are. But how it is we're here, we don't know.
Right, and, but impossible is not the same as I don't know. I don't know is not the same as impossible. Impossible to fully surmise, right? To fully grok, to have all the way tied up, you know, to have the infinite complexity of the universe tied up tidally within a mind which is of finite complexity in comparison to the infinite complexity of the mind or something. Sure, that doesn't seem reasonable. But it's not to know any one thing fully does seem impossible in a sense.
And then what about on the relative of diet then, on the level of intellectual diet, thought diet, thought form diet, thought form eating, thought form expressing, thought form tongue wagging, thought form
on the level of seasons,
like when one enters into prayer or meditation or tries to live a deeper, perhaps even more inwardly silent life to begin to hear God reaching into your life. Like the quality of feeling possessed by God has a very strong feeling of something coming to you, not from you. It has a strong feeling of being met by a being, being met by divine beings who find their source in inexpressible divinity to me. There's a way in which we have to work from both ends for me. I have to work from both ends. Yeah. And that it's not like I'm trying to find a midpoint but to enter into pure subjectivity, to enter into the possibility of pure objectivity, to let both those things go and enter into a silence that seems mute and unperturbed as to the question of whether it is subjective and objective. And all these things create a menu, a healthy diet. And what I felt was that my 15 years with in the teachings of Prasangika Madhyamika, Jesongkhapa, Dalai Lama's lineages, made me very conscious of certain ideas of emptiness or how I understood emptiness. And I believe I became poisoned by subjectivity, by the excesses of subjectivity. That's my own experience in the way I misunderstood that, in fact, you're ultimately, you are projecting your world. Now that also is empty, okay? And trying to understand what that means, the projector itself being empty, the one who is a movement of a wind inside a channel is behind the vision
wrong in that system to say that ultimately you are projecting your world.
Yeah, and you can't say, we're going to say relatively you're projecting your world. Sure, you're projecting your world. And the extent to which I misunderstood or understood that, it felt like a diet that was out of balance. It was too much meat in the Christian idea, not enough milk. It's very strong, very strong medicine. And I did feel an imbalance within the culture that we were within because of a misunderstanding of subjectivity to where it became a poison for people. It hurt people and it hurt me, my misunderstanding. And then for whatever reason, I have this strange experience that seems to be in many ways a culmination of our years together. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a negation, but rather almost, if you were to take Tantra, I mean, who is it that does the completion body? Who is it that makes you an angel? Who is there? Who is it that engages you in Kerem? Who is it that pushes you into a magical world where somehow your vision is changed? Who is it that does these things? Uh-huh. I mean, fuck. As hell doesn't feel like when one gets glimmers that it's me. It sure as hell doesn't feel like me, but it doesn't feel like not me.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
so where do I go?
And then when you say, look, it feels like someone's coming to me or not, like I don't know. It feels like none of these words tidily describe it all.
And never could.
Right.
Never could. Your love for Ken. Go ahead. Try to put into words how much I love Ezra. Good luck. But the words would certainly move me in that direction. It would be really helpful for you to describe that to me, Ben. Thank you. Please tell me with what you do, all the ways in which you heartily love your son. Times that by a million and you're not close. Thanks. Like that kind of thing.
Sure.
But
there's, you know, there's also no mundane thing we couldn't say that about, right? Try to describe every facet.
The taste.
Beautiful. Any object before you, the limitless facets. And so we can talk about a finite element in an infinite expanse, but it seems like each element is infinite as well. Which is not to say that you couldn't have more infinite. I mean, it's treated like an oxymoron or something, right? Infinite.
And you
plus
don't mean
one,
to do it that way. Yeah.
But it does. I mean, at least we could talk, I don't know, geometrically, we could talk about the difference between a line and a plane or something, right? A line extends infinitely in both directions, but a plane is an infinite collection of such lines
they touch.
Which is still not the same as space. We haven't even added
a third dimension.
Y-axis, the next axis that you add.
Oh, but you did because the line has thickness, so don't worry. Oh, you mean a line without thickness. Oh, okay.
Right, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
It does seem that you can have more infinity. That does seem to be an option. So can you be limited within infinity? We had a friend, Alexander Muir. We called it the spirograph debate. There was this question about whether or not every being has been your mother countless times. And this old Buddhist argument that it has to be true because you've lived countless lives. And there's this child's toy. I don't know if you remember this debate or you remember this toy, a spirograph. It's like a plastic wheel.
I do.
Right, with the little teeth on the inside and you've got Right, and you circle around. You've got the cogs go against each other on the inside. There's this little plastic, disc that goes on the inside. You put a pen in a hole and you go around and around. And I think the example he said was something like, how many times would you have to go around in a circle before you drew Ronald Reagan's face? And of course, you never would. Infinite times around the circle will not yield that. Just because you do something infinite times doesn't mean that you get every result. There's limitations within infinity. That is
fascinating.
Also possible.
That's very interesting.
And so I can exist as a being that could never be fully described. And I don't claim, when I say that things are conception or dependent upon conception, I don't claim that that means that somehow things can be tidally described. I don't claim that that denies infinity.
Or that, infinity. What about the reality of a rock?
Yeah.
But without a word or the is there? So for you, there is no being or pure act. Actus purus, to go to St. Thomas Aquinas in medieval Christian philosophy, based on Aristotelian philosophy, not to get fancy or nothing, but this pure act, actus, that God is pure act. And they're trying to get at, what's that?
I'm not saying that. I'm not denying it.
No, right. But what I'm, that there's, is there anything preconceptual? Is there a preconceptual, tangible world? Is there a preconceptual creation to which then we apply concept? Or in fact, we'd have to put it the other way. The world itself is the result of some kind of conceptualizing. With Christianity, we'd say God utters us into being, a word. Like a word, we are uttered into being by God, who empties God's self and holds me in being. How? By the utterance of me, who is a word. And you will be given a name when you turn into an angel of light. That will be your name alone and between you and your beloved, between the bride, that is the soul, and the bridegroom. There's this name. And so there's a sense in which word, language, languaging, conceptual, is deeply tied up into creative act, and it's spoken of. In the beginning was the word. Yeah. The word was made God. You know,
It would be absurd to deny a physical reality that exists prior to my placing a name upon it. And it would be absurd to assert that that reality could exist without me thinking of it as such.
Well, it would be absurd to say that reality exists without you, for you.
Yes, right. That's right.
That prepositional phrase is most necessary. Absolutely. You're telling me, Kevin, you can speak of a world that you have no idea about, you can't say anything about, that doesn't exist for you. I'm not saying the world doesn't exist. I'm not saying that world doesn't exist. It doesn't exist for you.
As I talk about a world that exists for someone other than me, this is still my perspective upon that world. The world didn't come into being when Ben was born. I'm not asserting such a world. You know, I'm not saying that suddenly the world came into being when my mind was developed to the capacity to create concepts. I'm saying that there's a world that existed before that. There was a world for my mother before that. And that I can't, and that to assert such a world without a mind to think of it as a world, as existing, as my mother's world, as your world that's not my world, as the world that the dinosaurs experienced, I'm saying still depends upon a mind, depends on conception. To talk about what is more infinite. You see, what is more complex than I could ever tidily wrap my mind around is dependent upon a mind. I'm not saying that there's no such thing as infinite complexity. I also think that that's dependent upon conception. But I also believe that there are things so complex that we can't wrap our mind around them, and that that's dependent upon our mind. Not to be wrapped around in the sense of understanding fully, but there are things beyond our understanding, and that's dependent upon a mind too.
And most things are beyond our understanding. I'm looking out at the forest. It's 99.9999999999999% of I don't know what the fuck is going on. Mm-hmm. Like,
right.
Okay, so
yeah, right.
And then I feel that the mystery beyond what I could ever know reaches into my life and changes me.
And 99.99%, like, it doesn't even begin to describe the problem. If you picked that 0.0001%, it's still 99.99% of that 0.001%.
Oh, you've got
you
it.
You see? Right. And the amount that we understand is so not just like, I like fleetingly small, you know, I don't know, because it has this sound of the amount that we understand fleeing before us almost as we try to zero in on it and could never find an iota of real understanding.
Okay. So then when we talk about the complex, the fragile complexities of the natural world and imagine them all coming together in ecosystems and incredible forms of interconnection, I'm not comfortable with, there must be a mind having a perception of that, a mind. Like there must be words or ideas or concepts occurring. That is for all those things to be occurring. We can say that is there a relationship between creator and creation, or is it simply unfolding? But the idea that the unfolding is contingent upon a mind knowing of the unfolding, well, that to me is God. What contingent upon what? Oh, I don't know, the being that's uttering all these complexities into being, which, by the way, does that not make a person want to bow down and beg for mercy and beg for help? And why is it that whether one is Prasangika Madhyamika or Saint John of the Cross via negativa, not a sweet nothingness, giving up of elaborations, resting in this infinite love, how is it that both seem to end in this devotion, this profound bowing down that really is a form of peace in this life before death? Like, how does your understanding of emptiness make you bow? And why does it? You know, and why does my understanding of God, what is it? And what is it in our lack of understanding that doesn't keep us in that frame of being, you know, that.
I mean, I don't know the answer exactly. I see of a great largeness and a magnificence to all that is and all that creates. And this unbelievable fortune that I don't know why I have the goodness around me that I do, people I love me, and the people that love me and the people that I know.
The people I love me.
And in some sense they are me, and in some sense that's not at all the case. And to say that they tidily, neatly are not me feels wrong. And to say that they tidily, neatly are actually me, it feels wrong. And and I don't understand exactly. It's too complex. All that has come before, all that has led to this, the infinite complexity that I can see in anywhere that I look, I don't understand. If there's
and yet,
too much,
and yet, yeah.
It's and yet, it's humbling. Point being, it's profoundly
point
humbling.
Being, yeah, yeah. And then yeah. somehow, when we connect in this intimacy of the intimacy of inquiry in the effort to, in a loving way, that intimacy of inquiry in love, it makes me feel more sane. I feel like there's more reality, or reality is able to be tapped. God is closer, and I can only experience that through others. Like, I cannot do this when I sense that God is reaching into my life. It's not like necessarily from like beyond or something, or it's what you just described. Like, how is it that there's all these loving people around me? Mm-hmm. How is it that I'm even able to just look at somebody and ask for something, and then it just arrives like perfectly brewed? I feel from you that your philosophical studies are working in the sense of creating more love. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I want to have these conversations with you. It's not even based on the clarity of your thinking about the philosophical undertakings and the understanding of reality that you've undertaken. It's this effect that is humility that expresses it as love, itself as love, it seems to me. And to what extent do you think that my mistaken understandings, potentially, of an objective world and the way that I express it is a roadblock to love? Do you feel in my expression of God, or my inability to express God, or my expression of the inability to express God, do you feel that this notion, and that it really came in 10 years ago during that somewhat of a conversion of life, really, where do you see the obstacles, you know?
I don't see you. I mean, it's two questions. Where do I see the obstacles? I don't know. But your previous question, do I see it as an impediment to love? No, I mean, that's not apparent to me on any level. And
it's engaged in ignorance.
Oh, well, this is this big question about what is ignorance. And is there a point at which, as we develop, does it become more or less important? It seems to be something emphasized.
Okay.
And I'm challenging nice, is nice. It seems to me important to you that being is not subjective, is not a subjective entity, that the truth of that being transcends the subjective, and that point of, I'm not sure how important that is or not. I'm probing at that because I'm not sure what I sort of see you as a guy with I think of Commissioner Gordon had this red phone that he could pick up for Batman or something. I feel like you have this like red phone to God where you just pick up the phone and you're looking to the sky with tear stained eyes. And that's like a superpower to me. I really have to get revved up. I mean, it doesn't feel as easy to me. And I don't know, you know, there's your makeup and my makeup. And I don't know to what extent, like, I suspect that for you, you might credit some of that to your understanding that this thing is so much bigger than you, could not be contained by you, could not be dependent upon your conception. It is primary, foremost, paramount, and ahead of all those things necessarily. And that's why you can so easily reach there. And I don't know that that should depend on that. I'm not convinced, you see, that the objectivity of the existence of such a thing should be necessary for there to be a being, a reality that is waiting for us all the time, that is available to us at any moment, where love resides and waits for us, which we can bring into ourselves, which we can bring to other people, but is not really from us, is not really from other people, and can be gifted and was already gifted and is always available. And that to say that is subjective, I'm not convinced that diminishes it one unfindable iota.
Well, and you might even say the opposite. And in fact, maybe. I'd have to say, maybe, and I have to say, God forbid, I should totally make God into an object or objectify mystery. So if I'm not in some way a divine spark, a part of a larger blaze, when my heart blazes up, and it very rarely, when the occasional moments of this profound warmth and union with my beloved, when the bride of my soul, you know, feels the kiss of my bridegroom's mouth, which I've never experienced, but when I feel like maybe I'm getting first glimmerings of such a thing, mm-hmm. I would have to say, given our training, it would be crazy to say there's not some way in which I am that which I am bowing down to. It would almost be a kind of insanity. And how could you even form anything? Kevin, what are you? So there's a sense in a graced conversion, or in the givenness of reality, seems to be, for even when we speak of a soul, sometimes I think I used to think of it as a child, as something within my body. Well, the soul in Christianity contains mind and body. Like we can't, like, so like there's a way in which it's wrong to think of even a spark within a blaze. Like and it would be wrong. See, objectivity can become a poison as well. Both, of course, and I believe that the objectifying of God and the misunderstanding of Christ as object who is Son of God has caused more suffering than anything in the world. I don't know if any boo-boo in religious history, in human history, has been more consequential and horrific than the pure objectification of God within Protestantism and Catholicism. So I please, like when you say, you described, by the way, you describe back to me, which is so beautiful, how closely you've listened to me over the years. And it really, you describe it in a way better than I can about my own self and sometimes. And I really appreciate it, because this has been fruitful for me.
I only realize now the word I was looking for even in that moment was primacy.
Premise.
Yeah.
That's definitely a portmanteau. That's like an anthem, you know?
Yeah,
anthem and anathema together, an anthem, the book you had me read, which is just great.
that being is the primary and the premise. You know, that there's a premacy, right? A supremacy, but a premise.
Oh, beautiful. Right? Okay.
That is necessary for the sake of interacting with that being. And I do believe that there is some way that one could balance both premacy and interdependence.
Interdependence, right. Indeed.
Yes, premacy and the dependence upon projecting upon a basis of projection.
Oh, I believe that too.
Projection.
I believe that too.
Which is not to say that there's no basis. And that's the mistakes of,
yes,
of Madhyamaka, yes, one of the fundamental mistakes of misunderstanding, you know, middle way Buddhist philosophy is to say that there is no basis.
Well, and now there can be a basis in which we interact with intimately on based on our understanding of emptiness. I mean, it wouldn't that there.
Right. Right.
There's a way in which it's the almost, wouldn't it be that the understanding of emptiness would ground us in the world of the senses more completely? It wouldn't lead to some odd transcendence or detachment from objects of the senses. Surely they would take on a truer life within our life, a truer vibrancy. A greater vibrancy or something.
I don't know. Right, and at the same time, as primary goals, they would ring hollow. These objects
as of primary the goals, they would ring hollow. These objects of the senses as primary goals.
Yeah, to say that I should gain this taste, that object or this object.
But oh, how the emptiness understander and lover of God enjoys that ice cream cone.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and so I.
Yeah, well, me as a I enjoy it. Forget emptiness.
I've always said I have more of a fat tooth than a sweet tooth, but yes.
Me, yeah. That's more accurate. It's the grease and the butter and the cream within a stout and the cream within the flavor of a coffee. Even there, you can feel as if there's something dairy-esque in a creamy.
right.
Even there, I have found the
contribution
cow.
To the growth of my derriere. I better go, dude.
Amen.
I love you, man. Thank you for the time. It was fruitful for me.
Me too.
Yeah, good. I'll talk to you very soon.
Love to Ezra, love to Kendra, love to you. I love you, bro.
Love you. Love your family. Talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.